column here, and these are consolidated cases. Kimberly Willoughby and Mark Bishop in Albemarle County Department of Social Services. This case is set for 20 minutes, I believe, for each side, correct?
Yes.
Is that the way it was set? 20 minutes for each side?
That's correct.
Okay. So, Counsel, you need to figure out how you want to divide up your time, figuring 10 and 10. And I think there's a lot of overlap from the government's position in the case.
I won't need much time.
Okay. All right. Said confidently. So let's take the 10 minutes, 10 minutes. I'm assuming that's what you want to do.
Your Honor, I am the guardian ad litem in this case, in all cases for the children, and I'm in support of what the department has presented, so I won't actually be making it.
So you won't need any time for argument? I appreciate that, ma'am. And you'll have 20 minutes, and as far as I'm concerned, you can segue between the two arguments. I think it'd be easy to understand that way because the issues are somewhat similar as I understand the case presented. There are a couple of little sub-issues in one of the cases that I understand. So what you can do, I would suggest, is take the 20 minutes. If you want to reserve time for rebuttal for the combination of cases, that's fine. If you'd like to segregate it, that's fine. And when we hear your argument, if you could go ahead and just combine the two and then talk about any sub-issues that you may have in the case.
Yes.
All right. Very good. Is that a general overview as to how we're going to handle things?
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. You would like the appellee to go first to cover both since one of the parties waived oral argument?
I think that might, unless you have an objection.
No.
Yeah, I think that's a more efficient way. It's a little bit different from the way that we typically do things, but I think it's probably more efficient that way.
Yes, sir.
Instead of working back to the middle, let's go from the front to the middle. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your consideration, counsel.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
And it is still good morning. Good
yes,
morning,
sir.
Your Honors. May it please the Court, Amanda Farley for the Albemarle County Department of Social Services. If I may just briefly, well, I'd like to address the Kimberly Willoughby case first, if I may.
Yes, ma'am.
And even though I would like to believe that every portion of my brief was gold, I would submit that the first issue, the evidentiary issue, is really not dispositive. And so unless the Court has any questions about that, obviously my argument is tiered. One, that the issue is not preserved. Second, that the appellant actually made a mischaracterization of the testimony that was considered, namely that it was from the instant case rather than a previous case because of how it was presented. But even if the Court finds my arguments persuasive on those two points, that the error would be harmless.
Yes, ma'am.
So again, unless there's any further question on that, I'll skip right past that one. Under the second assignment of error, my response is I'd like to characterize them as being five avenues to affirmation, if I could use alliteration to try to help me out a little bit. The first being procedural, and that is in the appellant's assignment of error, she failed to cite error under C2. Subsection Virginia Code 16.1-283C2. Even though it was discussed in argument, it was not specifically identified in the assignment of error. That being the case, procedurally, she has waived the objection as to C2. Therefore, it stands as a sufficient basis for termination. As such, it would be unnecessary to then discuss any of the evidence from the county as to B2. But again, if this Court finds it unpersuasive that she has actually waived that argument under C2, the Department forwards that there are four bases of substantive information that would allow this Court to resolve this in favor of the Department. The first is under C itself, that there is sufficient evidence under subsection C that would support the trial court's finding and that would allow this Court to find the trial court had sufficient evidence before it and that there was no error. The second is under B2A, which supports the finding under subsection B that the appellant had a mental illness or emotional defect as such that she was not able to properly parent her children.
And you're not suggesting in the context of this analysis that because of her difficulties emotionally and societally, that should be the reason for removing her children or taking her children away from her?
I would submit it would be sufficient unto itself, but it is not necessary to make that conclusion in this case because of the abundance of evidence. The third, under a substantive argument, would be under...
Another thing that's always, and I ask this a lot of times, particularly of counsel who are experienced in these kinds of matters and previously being a juvenile court judge, it's easy sometimes as a trial judge who's making these very critical determinations to take a look at circumstances and say, wow, you know, these kids were in a real tough environment, had real tough circumstances in the past, and now we placed them with foster care, and now they're thriving. And so let's just maintain the status quo, sort of losing the idea that, you know, these are this person's biological children, and they don't want to give them up, and most of the time they want to fight for them. How would you respond to how that balance should be struck in a situation like this?
Well, obviously, I mean, that would be the case for Ms. Willoughby today, as she has forwarded an appeal of what the trial court found. My response to that is, while it's clearly... I mean, I believe it's termed a great... It's the death penalty for parental rights. I mean, it is the most substantial and grave thing that one can do to sever a parent from their children. However, the guiding light in these cases, in the statute specifically, is the best interest of the children. And the statutory scheme is such that it is not a light decision. It is either based on the most egregious parental behavior or the most prolonged parental behavior that fails to seek any kind of remedy. So the default, but it's the touchstone of all of it is what is in the best interest of the children. And I think it does presume initially the best interests are going to lie with their biological parents.
Well, I think Judge Alston's point, which is a valid one, and it's one that I wrestle with quite often as well, is that best interest of the children is certainly a very important criteria, but thanks to Troxell, it's not the only criteria, because parents have a property right in their children, and taking their kids away from them permanently is obviously a very drastic and, as you pointed, a death penalty. It's a last resort, and you have to strike some kind of a balance. If all we ever did was determine what the best interests of the children are, we'd be taking a lot more kids away from their parents, quite
certainly.
Frankly. So.
Certainly, and to focus on the specific facts of this case, it was department put services in place long before there was actually a removal, and certainly before we got to the point of termination. There was initially a safety plan based on a report of a domestic violence incident between Ms. Willoughby and one of the involved children's father, but not the other.
Not Mr.
Account.
Bishop. Right.
Yes. So a safety plan was put in place to try to address the issues that became apparent. It was only upon Ms. Willoughby's arrest for DUI, when she admitted to smoking marijuana and having her child's father also intoxicated, and having, I believe it was an accident at a parking lot, that they actually proceeded to remove. And then, as I noted, it was approximately 18 months between the time of removal and to the actual and final termination of parental rights, during which, as I've cataloged in my brief, hosts of services, just one after the other, especially to Mother Miss Willoughby, and that was before she became incarcerated.
Let me interrupt you and ask you this question. It's clear to me that Judge Higgins, at least a significant factor in her decision to terminate parental rights, was the fact that Miss Willoughby was engaging in criminal activity while she had custody of her children in the home, essentially.
Yes.
And she relied upon her own recollection of events at a criminal trial. And while that seems to be one of the issues that's being argued on appeal, was whether that was proper. And I guess ultimately my question to you is whether, is it error, or if it is, would it be harmless error? Because I know while a court can certainly take judicial notice of its own records, what it can't do, I would suggest to you, I mean, by that I mean, yes, somebody was charged with and convicted of a certain crime, but in terms of the actual testimony in those cases, I think that is not something that's normally subject to judicial notice. It has to be, you know, proven, proper foundation laid, that sort of thing. It could be through a transcript, but none of that was done here. It was the court basically testifying in effect, or acting in effect as a witness to testimony, which, you know, at least the appellant here argues was improper. So I guess my question, circle back, is simply, is that error? If not, why not? If so, was it harmless? And if so, why?
Not error. and if it is harmless, which is the only answer.
Why not error?
Certainly, certainly. Well, first of all, Your Honor, it was waived because the
objection... So it was error, but just waived. It wasn't...
No, I just want to cover all of it. But it was waived in this case because it was never mentioned in the 3 points in the testimony in which her prior adjudication or prior sentencing specifically was referenced. There was no objection until a written objection on a single page that was filed with the order subsequent to court. And there was no countersignature to that page. I never saw it until I was preparing for this appeal and reviewed the court's file. The court was never asked to rule on that objection.
So I understand your point is the objection was not timely, not that it wasn't waived, it simply was not a timely objection.
Well, yes, correct.
Okay.
Secondarily, was it error? And no, I would submit in this case, it wasn't just that she was referring to testimony from a prior matter. That was actually brought up. The appellant herself brought up the sentencing and her testing positive at her sentencing in her own direct examination.
So we could essentially excise that record of adjudication and rely simply on the record of her own testimony, placing that issue as to her status or prior status or difficulties before the fact finder.
Yes, but even to that, I specifically asked on cross-examination about those statements made in her prior hearing, which she equivocated about. And then after cross, and I believe after guardian ad litem asked questions, the court specifically, using the cue of what my questions were, asked Ms. Willoughby questions about that sentencing and about what she said in the context of that sentencing.
So there's independent evidence.
Correct. That's right. It was not that she referred to a prior transcript. She relied on the information that was reintroduced essentially as impeachment evidence within this hearing. So that's why I would submit it's not error. If you find me unpersuasive to that point, it's harmless because what is uncontested is that she... Ms. Willoughby was convicted, that she was incarcerated, that she tested positive at the time of her sentencing, and by her own admission, she was cooking cocaine. The only thing that was at issue was whether or not she was cooking it for her child's father or she was cooking it generally. And that, frankly, in the...
Hardly material in terms of
right.
You know, who the drug customers are.
It doesn't
are.
Really pivot the case, so that I would submit that.
We've been talking quite a bit about Ms. Willoughby. Let's talk about Mr. Bishop.
Yes, sir.
It seems that Mr. Bishop was an advocate of pushing for a goal of adoption as opposed to termination, correct?
Well, he was actually advocating in the opposite because the court approved the goal of adoption for the current relative
correct.
Placement. And my reading is that Mr. Bishop objects to that. And in perfect candor with this court, I'm not new to this court, I'm not new to the practice, but I haven't appeared on many cases on appeal such as this. But I will admit to some confusion as to what the actual argument was from the appellant, Mr. Bishop, because it seemed to me the argument was that the court should have considered relative placement and that the child should have been placed with a relative.
Don't feel bad. I was thoroughly confused by the brief in this case because I wasn't sure if he was arguing the error was in not placing the child in foster care with with his mother versus the other relatives that they were placed with, or the fact that the goal was changed to adoption. I just wasn't clear on what the argument there was, so don't feel bad.
Thank you. But to the extent that it was an argument about relative placement, she was placed. There was some initial question about whether or not Mr. Bishop was the father of the child at issue. So while that determination was ongoing, they explored maternal relatives. A maternal relative was identified. That's where the child was placed, remains to this day.
Does the law suggest any preference for placement with a grandparent or a sibling versus a relative that's maybe not so close?
I don't believe the statute has language specific enough to make that requirement.
And there's no case law that would suggest that.
No. I mean, I think any interested party can include a grandparent, clearly, any biologically related individual. But I would submit, just on a policy argument, that...
A relative's a relative.
A relative's a relative. And because it's so situational, a relative that may be a little bit more... extended than a grandparent may be a much better fit for various reasons, and that to make a scheme that's so directive toward degrees of separation would be disadvantageous to children in specific situations.
So is it fair to say that, let's assume there's three relatives that are willing to take the child, DSS then does a deep dive to determine factually which relative would be best for placement, and then that's the evidence that comes before the judge?
Indeed. And that's, I submit, that happened exactly in this case. And furthermore, Mr. Bishop, he sanctioned the placement. There are letters that were entered into evidence in this trial that he wrote to the farmers and to the child, in which he approved of the placement, said he was glad that she was with people that loved her, and only hoped that his family would be able to see the child. And I, even though I didn't really cover this in my brief, I'd also submit that it's not entirely clear on the record whether they're asking for placement or visitation, because it seems to waffle between the two. In Appendix 704, they requested a visitation around the birthday. Appendix 706, Ms. Bishop indicated she wanted a couple days here and there and see if things would work out. Then in Appendix 716, Mark Bishop, in the appellant, in his own testimony, said if the child can't live with his parents, then maybe just visit. So it's, you know, as a foundational matter, it's not really clear what they're actually asserting.
Correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm trying to remember my juvenile court work. Once the termination occurs, isn't it in fact true that opportunities for visitation sort of disappear for the biological parent?
There's nothing that compels that.
Okay, yes. Then I do recall, and that may be why he took such inconsistent positions, because a lot of times when you're dealing with people who are struggling like this, they don't really understand what the consequences of this very harsh and, as you pointed out, death penalty and draconian determination. I'm not saying you're being harsh, but that the department is being harsh. Once they figure out the depth of what's going to happen, they sort of say, whoa, I didn't
give me anything.
I want to still stay in this person's life. I believe that these people who are taking care of my child are good people, but goodness gracious, I don't want to be mixed out of this thing, and so that's why I am having sort of inconsistent positions in this case.
And I've spent a substantial amount of time thinking about that, and does, especially to what I gathered was the appellant's point, that relative placement, indefinite relative placement, the argument is better than terminating.
Well, that's pretty much cleared up by our case law, Stanley versus Fairfax DSS, is you can't do that.
Well, right, and the obviously my argument is that if a relative is a good placement, then adoption, allowing them to be adopted by that relative is something that a child should be afforded, the opportunity should be afforded. Of course, that assumes that the parent is correctly in a position that they should have their rights terminated. But if that is the case, and if we assume that just for the moment for argument, then indefinite placement versus the opportunity to be legally adopted. I have to submit that the best interest of the child is that they should be able to have that legal status and not be denied that just because there may be interested parties that have some biological relationship.
It trumps the inherent biological rights that a biological parent may have.
Certainly. Okay. And right. I don't know if I'm allowed rebuttal. Should I?
What we'll do is, because this case is an unusual posture, if you want the opportunity to speak again, we'll give you an opportunity. Counsel has been very
I think, in fairness, we should let the appellant have the last word, though.
Yeah. So. We'll see how it works out.
Thank you.
All right, sir. And again, I appreciate your willingness to sort of change the format. I think it's probably the easier way to do this case.
Absolutely, Judge Ralston. These are very difficult cases. Again, good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Graham. I represent Mark Dwayne Bishop on this appeal.
Let me start you out, Mr. Graham, because I'm confused as well about the assignment of error here. Quoting from the assignment of error, the trial court erred in denying your client's motion to reject the appellee's petition to change foster care permanency plan from return home and relative placement to adoption when Bishop provided sufficient evidence to support a finding of at least one close relative with whom the child had a prior relationship was willing and qualified to be considered for placement. So I'm struggling to understand, is the issue changing it to adoption, or is the issue the placement with this particular relative? I'm thinking the latter, but because that's where the argument seems to go from there, but the former is also in there as well. So what are we deciding here?
I'll be brief, Your Honor. I was running around the house when I was about 11 or 12 years old. I broke a lamp. My mother chastised me. I said, but I didn't mean to. And I said, she said, but the road to hell was paved with good intentions. I'm sorry, when I write these things, I really do try to be clear and concise and not be confusing. The foster care goal is return home, relative placement, or adoption. Those are generally the three choices we have. Return home and relative placement are usually synonymous. You can almost draw a hash mark between the two, and then you've got adoption over here. So the issue really was, he did object to changing the foster care goal from return home slash relative placement to adoption.
But the entire argument then from there seemed to focus, at least maybe I'm misreading your brief, seemed to focus on the fact that there should have been this indefinite placement with his mother rather than
the
cousin or
right.
whatever.
My client's incarcerated until, I think, 2038.
43. Yeah.
So he really had no case here of his own. He couldn't participate in services. He wanted the court to consider his mother, the child's.
Well, the court certainly did consider it, but obviously didn't adopt his recommendation. And
correct.
Clearly the record reflects, at least in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below, the record reflects that the child is thriving in the situation that the court ordered. So given that, I mean, where's the reversible error here?
Your Honor, in drafting this up, I mentioned to Ms. Farley, we did place with relatives. So I'm objecting to placing with relatives. It seems inconsistent. My client wanted the court to consider consider placement of his daughter NH with his mother, Mrs. Bishop.
Well, you want
paternal grandma.
Well, and, I mean, your client wanted placement,
yes,
to be not consider, but wanted the child to be placed with his mother.
Yes, and because the trial court did not do that, he asked that an appeal be filed.
Okay,
and the only argument that seemed appropriate was that it was an abuse of discretion to take a more distant relative for placement as opposed to a more direct relative.
That's certainly a good faith argument that you can make. We appreciate your position vis-a-vis your client's wishes here. But I think you'd have to concede that the case law, I mean, Stanley certainly seems to stand for the proposition that your client's wishes really couldn't be honored to the extent that he might expect. It seems to me the trial court clearly did consider the mother, just rejected because of the fact that at some point that he was going to be coming back and living there, and you know.
That's exactly correct.
You would agree, wouldn't you? And again, I appreciate your candor on these issues. You would agree that the department, when it took a look at how to best deal with the situation, considered whether or not your client agreed with them or not, considered every viable option for the placement of these children.
And I was not attorney of record for the trial court, and it was interesting because I saw one of these cases, I believe, as the Court of Appeals sees them, just from the record. And yes, they did consider Mrs. Bishop for placement. They just placed the child with the family.
And you appreciate that the standard of review that we have in considering the trial court's ultimate determinations is one of abuse of discretion.
Yes.
Okay.
And as without merit or plainly wrong or without evidence to support it.
And one final question in that regard. What evidence, under the appropriate standard, I believe it's clear and convincing at this point, would you suggest that the trial court abuses discretion? I guess that's the whole nut of the case.
That is, Your Honor. So the record didn't.
Well, let me see if I can help you, because I'll tell you what I understand your argument to be, and maybe this answer shows Olson's question, and if I'm wrong, then you need to correct me, because then I'll have a question. But I understood your brief to basically concede that the statute does not expressly require relative placement, but your argument seems to be that implicitly relative placement is preferable.
Yes.
would it be fair to say that the statute doesn't say that, and while relative placement often is part of the best interest calculation because to some extent at least it keeps a family together, it's not the criteria that you actually, in other words, it's sort of an ancillary result as a, you know, when you consider the best interest. The best interest quite often, you know, where you have a choice, relative placement will result in that being in the best interest because of the fact that they're part of the family, the child is usually familiar with the relative, as in this case they may have younger siblings that the child can bond with cousins, that sort of thing. But the statute doesn't expressly say that, and it's never been, and this court has never held, that the court has to give preference ipso facto to that. It just is the sort of natural result of applying a best interest analysis to the totality of the circumstances.
It is, Your Honor. It seems to follow the statutory construction and the way.
So if that's the case, then how did the trial court err? Get back to Judge Alston's question.
And this would be my Mr. Bishop's argument, that it erred by placing the child with somebody the child was relatively unfamiliar with the farmers and was very familiar with his mother, Mrs. Bishop. And that would be the error that Mr. Bishop would allege, that they were placed with a relative, but one with whom the child had very little contact prior to becoming into the foster care system, whereas opposed to the paternal grandmother, Mrs. Bishop, she had more substantial contact and a more substantial relationship, and it was a closer relationship. It's a paternal grandmother as opposed to, I think, a first cousin. And so, to answer your question, if you look at the statutory construction, there seems to be a preference for placement at home. If we can't do that, we've got relative placement. If we can't do that, permanent foster care or adoption become the options. I've done a lot of these, and I still get confused, Judge.
I think you stated the standard correctly, and your argument essentially in response to both my question and Judge Humphrey's question is that based upon the scheme that has been developed under this statutory framework, that the trial court erred in not giving more weight to the primary, should be the primary objective for the placement of the child.
Yes.
Okay.
And I think that's why that's where the good intentions fall. Your Honor, I thought I was clear enough for this. I'm sorry I was confusing, because that just makes your job more difficult.
We work hard. We can work our way through things, and we understand oftentimes that counsel is placed in a position where the position that they must take it to zealously advocate for the best interest of their client is not one that's necessarily supported by relevant case law. So we get it.
And that's why I underlined Stanley. Does Stanley address that hierarchy, Judge Humphreys?
No, I think Stanley just stands for the proposition that indefinite placement is as opposed to changing the goal to adoption is not in the child's best interest. I think
the best case for you is Farrell.
I just wanted to write these down.
That's the best case for you is Farrell. I wrote that.
For future reference, I like to write these things down so that I can be more articulate and more complete. I'm running out of time here, but unless the court has any other questions for me,
We appreciate your argument, sir.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right, we'll give you a moment in response if counsel has anything she wants to offer.
It will be extremely brief. I only wanted to point out, Your Honor, that there are a number of cases that this court has decided that unpublished, or at least the ones that I recall, in which grandparents were considered and rejected given the particular facts of that case. So there is precedent in this court to consider that families, relatives, don't necessarily trump even prior strangers given certain circumstances, and I would submit this case as one. Thank you.
Sir, did you have anything you wanted to say?
What could I have done to make it more clear to flesh out my issues so I don't confuse you guys next time? That would be my only question. I spent hours trying to make this as precise and non-confusing as possible.
I guess we owe you a CLE program.
We'll come down to Greek counsel.
Sometimes the standard of proof and the standard of review are swimming in my head. And it's,